This is the first Sunday of the month, and we'll be taking steps 1 and 2. This is Mike, Alcoholic. Welcome to Beginner's Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous Group. We are recreating the beginner's classes from the early 1940s and 50s when the sobriety rate was an average of 75%. In Cleveland, it was as high as 93%. We take the 12 steps every month. On the first Sunday of the month, we take steps 1 and 2. Second Sunday, steps 3, 4, and 5. Third Sunday, 6 through 10. And on the fourth Sunday, we take steps 11 and 12. We take the 12 steps at the group level as an overview. For those who want to take the 12 steps on a one-to-one basis, please connect with a sharing partner. A sharing partner is a person who has taken all 12 steps, recovered from alcoholism, has had a spiritual awakening, and is willing to work with the newcomer. Will the sharing partners who want to work with others please raise your hand? Thank you. For the people that want to take the 12 steps, please connect with a sharing partner after the meeting ends. We have big books for sale at group cost of $8. Each page and paragraph is numbered. Please do not write in a book. This is the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. Here's a quote from our co-founder Bill Wilson, written in the 1958 AA Grapevine. Sobriety, freedom from alcohol, through the teaching and practice of the 12 steps, is the sole purpose of an AA group. End quote. For those who want their paper signed, please hang on to them till after the meeting is over. We will sign them after the meeting is over, after we had said the Lord's Prayer. Sometimes this meeting goes over 1 hour. If you have to leave it at 7:30, do not expect to have your court paper signed. Or if you have to leave before 7:30, again, do not expect to have your court paper signed. We sign the papers after the meeting is over, after we had said the Lord's Prayer. This is done as a courtesy. It's not mandatory that we sign your paper. Please silence your cell phones. Please no texting during the meeting or talking. Let's take a moment of silence to invite the God of our own understanding into our hearts and remind ourselves why we are here tonight, followed by the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. We'll be passing the basket now for the seventh tradition. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. Thank you. For those who can get on the internet, we do have resources online for these workshops. We have a MP3 format, file format, and PDFs for the handouts. They are posted on the website spiritualsteps.com Again, spiritualsteps.com. We have the workshop for Paul Fisher, Brian and Catherine, and Ken B. And again, spiritualsteps.com. For those who want to go to YouTube, we have a YouTube site dedicated to Alcoholics Anonymous. Simply Google AA100011, and that will take you directly to the YouTube channel, where currently there's over 19,000 subscribers and over 370 videos, A to Z, pertaining to Alcoholics Anonymous and recovery from alcoholism. And again, that YouTube channel, simply Google AA100011, and it'll take you directly to that YouTube channel. Thank you. Before we start the steps tonight, we have a 20-minute talk briefly describing the Back to Basic format as it was done back in the 1940s.
Our special guest today, I am really honored that he is able and willing to join us. Wally P. is the author of Back to Basics, the Alcoholics Anonymous Beginners Meetings, and also How to Listen to God, Overcoming Addiction Through the Practice of Two-Way Prayer. Wally P. is the originator of the Back to Basics Beginners Meetings, which have grown to thousands of groups across the country and in other countries as well. Wally P. has himself taken over 10,000 people through the 12 steps, Wally himself, and has witnessed countless miracles of recovery. Wally P., welcome and thank you for joining us on the Dr. Carol program today.
Thank you, Dr. Carol. Thank you for this opportunity to join you and your listeners.
I want to say, first of all, that I, with you, am grateful that God has brought you health. I know you had some health challenges. You're doing well. You're traveling again. And I'm really excited about that for you and also for the people that you're able to share this good news with. Wally, I know many people, and I'm sure many of our listeners, have heard about the 12-step programs, and many people have found a lot of benefits there. But there have also been some that have found that maybe the way they've experienced the 12 steps hasn't been completely successful. What do you think are some of the things about the way the 12-step programs are usually practiced that, well, may not really be as helpful as they should be?
Well, in the early days of the 12-step movement, the steps weren't an option. They were a necessity. This is what a newcomer did. In fact, in many areas of the country, you could not go to a regular meeting until you had actually completed all 12 steps. And back then, they handed out what was called a sobriety card, and it had two dates on it, the date that you entered the 12-step community and the date you finished the steps. And typically, that was done within a matter of a few weeks. Today, we have two schools. And one is the fellowship of recovery, and the other is the program of recovery. And in terms of the fellowship, many people here don't drink and go to meetings, 90 meetings in 90 days, and things like that, which are actually contrary to what was actually practiced in the early days, which was, oh, and another one was meeting makers make it. Well, in the early days, it wasn't meeting makers who made it, it was step takers who make it. And that's what we're seeing, is that people that are getting reconnected with the steps, getting reconnected with the original program, are seeing the same success that they saw back in the 1940s and 1950s. And I've just been blessed to be a part of this movement. Just wanted to say as an aside that I make no money from the sale of any book or literature that has my name on it. This is my 12-step work for which I cannot be paid. This is my gift to the recovery community, and what an honor it is to be able to give this away.
Oh, thank you, Wally, for saying that and for sharing with us today. Want to let our listeners know that we have some links on our website, some articles that you have made available, and also links to the Back to Basics book that you have authored. Wally, talk about some of the parts of or what's different about the Back to Basics approach to the 12 steps that you have found has made the difference for people.
I don't think it's a question of difference. It's a question of reconnecting with what worked, Bill W. and Dr. Bob and the pioneers put together as a very simple and straightforward approach to the steps. The Big Book was written with the assumption that the steps would be taken in a matter of a few hours, and that's the way it was practiced in the early days. I am again, blessed. Thank you for commenting with good health, and I'm back on the road taking people through the steps. I do it on weekends during a day. We start at 9 o'clock in the morning on step one, and by 4:30 in the afternoon, we've taken all 12 steps, including a fifth step. We have a two-hour lunch break for take the fifth step, and then other groups are doing a one-week version where you take session one on Monday, session two on Tuesday, you do a fifth step on Wednesday, session three on Thursday, and session four on Friday. And there's over 6,000 groups now each meeting each week which are taking the steps in 4 one-hour sessions over the course of a month, such as every Wednesday night. Last Monday I was in Lake Oswego, Oregon, and I was at their beginners meeting. Wednesday I was at the beginners meeting in Anacortes, Washington. Next Wednesday I'm going to be at the beginners meeting, or one of the several beginners meetings, in Vancouver, British Columbia, and then Thursday we're going over to Vancouver Island and see the beginners, witness the beginners meetings there.
Wow, that is awesome. Now, Wally, you talk about taking people through these steps in a matter of hours or at most a few weeks. That seems so revolutionary to people that may have been in recovery programs or 12-step programs for years, and, oh, maybe now I'm on step five or working on step seven. It's a very different approach. Is there any benefit to doing the 12 steps repeatedly? I can imagine if you do it all in a day or in a few weeks, there may still be other things that you have to learn to grow into.
Let me give you a quote from Bill W., co-founder of the first of the 12-step programs, and he made this statement in 1951, speaking from the podium in Hollywood, California. And this is a quote: "Don't make a project out of working the steps. Go through your day being the sort of person you'd like to be, trying to help someone else, and making sure you don't hurt anyone. And when you get to the end of your day, review the 12 steps, and you'll find that you have worked all of them." So the co-founder of the first of the 12-step programs was giving us the statement that we're to take all 12 steps each and every day. And I do that. I do a surrender each morning. I share with others throughout the day. I make amends quickly if I've harmed anyone. I forgive people who may have harmed me. And I, as part of my morning quiet time, I listen to the indwelling spirit, and I write guidance, and I follow it to the best of my ability during the day and review it at night, and try to help somebody else at least one or two each and every day. When people would ask in the early days, what step are you on, the answer was all of them.
I think that is a very wonderful approach. This becomes a way that you live every day. And as that quote that you read, not getting bogged down at any one particular point. Well, you mentioned something that I want to hopefully have you elaborate on a little bit, and that's, you mentioned surrender. I know that is a word that's regularly talked about. Another word is powerless in the first three steps. I know also that some people I have been aware of who are in 12-step programs or trying to overcome an addiction will say, oh, I'm just praying and asking God to take care of this for me. Talk about how relying on God or surrender to God and that thought, how do you connect that with the need to take action and do something on your part? How do you work all that out?
Well, the surrender is essential, and that is really the heart and soul of the beginning of the journey, or the beginning of each day, is to acknowledge that we can't do this alone. This is a we program. We read the big book together, we take the steps together, and we recover together. So part of that we program includes the God of our understanding. Some people call it spirit or the indwelling spirit. Many, many different names for this power, greater than human power, that resides inside each and every one of us. So that's the key, is that it is an inner journey. It's a journey to determine which course to take each and every day by listening and receiving guidance. And we typically take action on guidance that passes the test of forgiveness and faith or love and unselfishness and honesty. And hopefully we don't take action on anything that we receive that has to do with resentment or fear or selfishness or dishonesty. So we have a test to separate what the pioneers called self-will from God's will. And I use a little 2012 version of it when I'm taking people through the work, especially in large groups. I talk about the voice of addiction versus the voice of recovery, and can you tell the difference between the two voices? Well, the pioneers gave us a test to separate those two voices, and hopefully we're able to learn from this. That's why we have sharing partners, because we may think it passes the test, and our sharing partners or sponsors or spiritual guides may think otherwise, and it's a topic that we open up for discussion.
We do have a caller, Wally. Would you be willing to talk to one of our callers for a moment?
Oh, absolutely.
I had a question for you, Wally. It all sounds, I appreciate the fact that you're going back to the sort of back to the basics, right? Or back to the founder's intent for the program. And I agree that a lot of things have happened over the years. What particularly interests me is the fact that you have been discussing going through the steps in such rapid fashion. I agree they can sometimes drag on unnecessarily and people hem and haw. But my question revolves around the action steps 4, 5, 8, and 9 and how you achieve that, or, you know, how do you do those in such a quick manner and do them thoroughly enough that they're so critical to do completely. I'm sure you understand what I mean. How do you address that so quickly?
Oh, excellent question, Jason. Let me talk about that particular part of the program in terms of a concept that's relatively new. It's not a concept from the 40s or 50s, but one that I particularly enjoy in terms of a visualization is that we peel the onion. That's why we take the steps again and again and again and again. And the key is to get through that process in one sitting. The sponsor and the newcomer sit down together, and the sponsor asks the questions, and the newcomer does the talking, and the sponsor actually writes the four-step. I know this sounds like heresy to some people today, but this is the way it was done. And as an archivist historian for the 12-step community and having had open access to every archival collection in the United States and Canada, and interviewing more than 200, 300 people that got sober in the 1940s, I am passing on their message and not mine. that it was done in one sitting, and then you talk about it, and then you come up with an amends list, and then you role play the amends. And part of the amends was the concept that the sponsor was the first person the newcomer saw after an amends was made, either in person or over the telephone. And but the whole process of doing this in one sitting is part of the way of looking at the steps as a continuum rather than as 12 distinct and separate entities, a continuum,
Wally,
of process.
Wally, I'm sorry, we are running a little close to our break. Are you able to perhaps hold on for a few minutes? I love this discussion, and if you're able,
certainly,
maybe we could just have you hold on for a few minutes after our break.
I would be honored.
Our very special guest today, Wally P., is the author of Back to Basics, the Alcoholics Anonymous Beginner's Meetings, and also How to Listen to God, Overcoming Addiction Through the Practice of Two-Way Prayer. Wally has taken over 10,000 people through the 12 steps of recovery over very short periods of time. And we've been talking with Wally about the Back to Basics approach, and Jason, calling while driving his truck through Kentucky, was asking Wally about the action steps, the four particular action steps in the 12-step programs, and taking those very, very quickly. And I think, Wally, you gave a very good synopsis of answering that. You need to at least get a certain level through those action steps quickly, even though you may have to come back and do more later. Am I right there?
Oh, yes. And let me clarify for Jason and the rest of the listeners that back to basics, we describe it in terms of the tourniquet, and I found it ironic that today is the on this date the Band-Aid was invented. That's another way of looking at these beginners meetings and the back to basics approach. And the example would be a hospital. If you go to the hospital and you have a knife wound and you're bleeding profusely, the doctor doesn't hand you a book and send you home and tell you to read it. He or she puts on the tourniquet and then moves on to the next emergency patient. And then another person will come along and suture up the wound, and possibly a third person come along and put on the bandage and give you a shot of antibiotics and send you home. Back to basics is just the tourniquet. This is just to keep you alive long enough so that you can take the steps in more depth and detail again and again and again and again and get deeper into those layers of the onion. If you don't put the tourniquet on, you're not going to be alive long enough to take the steps in more depth and detail.
Does that help, Jason?
Yes, that's a great answer. Thank you, Wally. As you said, there's a whole lot. I've heard that expression myself in the rooms a number of times, of course, and it's a very good analogy for the process of undoing so many years of having lived with this illness and all the destructive events that have happened in your life. So I appreciate the time today. Thank you for having me on, and it was great to talk to you both. And thank you, Wally.
Wally, another question that I hope you can address. Your book, How to Hear from God, the Two-Way Prayer, and I know you've alluded to that a couple times. Just briefly share what that whole practice is about.
This practice has been around for centuries and centuries. It's not unique to the 12-step community, though our 11-step makes it crystal clear as to what we are to do in terms of action. It says, sought through prayer and meditation. Prayer is talking to God, talking to the indwelling spirit, typically in prayer. But the second half of it is listening for the answers. It's a two-way communication because, as a result of becoming a listener, and that's what many of the pioneers consider the steps all about. Steps 1 through 10 were to remove the blocks that prevent us from becoming effective listeners. Step 11 teaches us how to listen. And step 12, we let God do the talking as we work with others. So it is about listening, and it is about being guided in terms of messages that we receive either through sight or sound or sensation or a knowing. Those are the four channels that that Bill described on page 14 of the Big Book: sight, sound, sensation, and knowing. And then further on in the Big Book, it talks about inspiration, intuitive thought, or a decision is how the spirit will talk to us, through inspiration, intuitive thought, or a decision. And we have to be careful with the decisions, because it could be a yes or no, but keep in mind that wait is a decision. And be careful.
That's right.
With the fourth one. If you insist on taking your will back, guess what? We get it back, and then we're off to the races, and usually with very negative consequences. So it's a powerful tool. There are 11-step guidance meetings that have sprung up all over the country and around the world where people actually use this as a meeting format. It was a meeting format in the early days of the recovery movement, started in Dr. Bob's living room in the summer of 1935. Bill and Bob both practiced it on a daily basis. And it has become a lost piece of our history that's now being, rediscovered and reemphasized.
I want to let our listeners know that you have made some articles available that we have put links to on our website. I was really touched by one of them. You had a large number of quotes from people who have experienced the Back to Basics Beginners meetings, some who were beginners, but some who continue to include that approach in their daily life of living healthy and recovery. I have to say, I was rather touched by some of those letters and stories of people who have really, really found healing and recovery in this approach. I imagine you hear that a lot, Wally.
Oh, I am so blessed, Dr. Carroll, to receive all of this very, very positive feedback, and not just from the people that I've taken through the steps personally, but the thousands of people that are conducting the meetings, and the more than 500,000 people that have been through the work, and also how the work has been incorporated into other 12-step programs other than the original basic recovery for food addiction and basic recovery for sex addiction. And the General Service Office in New York has asked us to reserve Back to Basics for the first of the 12-step programs having to do with alcohol. It is equally applicable to other addictions and other obsessive compulsive behaviors, and I received the emails, I received the telephone calls. I just got a phone call earlier this week from a man who was returning to Russia. He started Back to Basics in St. Petersburg and had Back to Basics translated into Russian, and then he took it to Moscow, came back to the United States, for a few months to basically unpack and repack, and now he's going back to Russia to plant more, beginners meetings in other, cities in Russia. And the book has been translated into Chinese and Japanese, Polish and Norwegian, German and Spanish, and all of this is done for fun and for free. No money ever changes hands, and I get to witness the miracles because somehow or other they find the time and a phone number and give me a call. It's just an awesome to hear about their miracles.
Well, Wally, I want to say God bless you. Keep spreading the message. You know, you have really touched my heart, and I know our listeners. I appreciate you taking some of your weekend time from your spending some time with your family to be with us today. We're really pleased and honored, and go with God.
Oh, you too. And as Dr. Bob and Bill used to say, keep it simple and pass it on.
Keep it simple and pass it on. Thank you, Wally, and we'll have to stay in touch.
Bye-bye
now.
Thank you, Dr. Carroll.
This is Mike, alcoholic. Okay, tonight we're going to cover steps 1 and 2. Let's go to page 59 and let's listen or read the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. 1. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God, as we understood him. 4. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5. Admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6. Were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7. Humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8. Made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9. Made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10. Continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God, as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Okay, let's start with step one.
We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable.
Let's go to page 30, paragraph 2. Page 30, paragraph 2.
Chapter 3. More about alcoholism. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery, the delusion that we are like other people, or presently may be, has to be smashed. We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. We know that no real alcoholic ever recovers control.
Okay, a couple points here in this last paragraph. We're going to smash the delusion that you're not alcoholic, and also there's the question, do we concede to our innermost selves that we're alcoholics? So we'll come back to that. We're going to go in and listen to some of these quotes out of the book, and hopefully it will be convincing that you will concede to your innermost self that you are truly an alcoholic, and you'll know what the definition of the word alcoholic means. Okay, let's go to page XXVI, XXVI, first paragraph. And it starts with, "We believe."
We believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy, that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker.
Okay, there you have it. Dr. Silkworth in the chapter, the doctor's opinion, just defined what an alcoholic is. An alcoholic has a physical phenomenon of craving once he puts alcohol in his body. Non-alcoholics physically don't crave alcohol. And that's where he says never. The word never means not one time.
That the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy. That the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker.
Okay, on the same page, XXVI, let's go to the bottom of the page, the last paragraph where it says men and women drink.
Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that, while they admit it is injurious, they cannot after a time differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontented, unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks, drinks which they see others taking with impunity. After they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful, with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over. And unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope of his recovery.
Okay, let's unpack that last paragraph, or the last two paragraphs, where it says men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. Is that true or false? I know it was true for me because I am an alcoholic. I love the feeling of drinking. I basically love drinking. Didn't care for the consequences and all the suffering. But, yeah, I agree. I did enjoy drinking and I did like the effects. At the end of my drinking, I couldn't get drunk.
They are restless, irritable, and discontented, unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks.
Restless, irritable, and discontent. That is a dry drunk. And, you know, I could tell you I'm an alcoholic because when I wasn't drinking, the way I felt was pretty raw. Taking a few drinks, I did feel that sense of ease and comfort.
After they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops,
after I have succumbed to the desire again, that means I'm thinking about it, I'm not drinking. That is the mental obsession. And then I have the phenomenon of craving, the physical phenomenon of craving. So here in this last paragraph, we have alcoholism and all its insanity.
And unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope of his recovery.
In this last part, it talks about a psychic change, a personality change that means your mind will change, that you will have a spiritual awakening. You'll get this through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that, while they admit it is injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontented, unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks, drinks which they see others taking with impunity. After they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful, with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over, and unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope of his recovery.
Okay, at this point we have established that we have a physical phenomenon, a craving, and only an alcoholic has this. And also there's a mental obsession. We think about it, we desire it, and that is why your life is unmanageable. At least that's why my life was unmanageable, because I was always picking up that first drink and then starting that physical phenomenon craving, and I was off to the races. In step one, it says, we admit that I am powerless over alcohol, that my life is unmanageable. Or do I concede to my innermost self that I am an alcoholic? That's a yes or no question. And once you own this, that your body is basically different, that you can never safely take a drink, you truly are powerless. No amount of willpower will stop this. And why we take the steps is to have a psychic change or spiritual awakening. Let's go to page 30, paragraph 1.
Chapter 3. More about alcoholism. Most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. No person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery, the delusion that we are like other people, or presently may be, has to be smashed. We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. We know that no real alcoholic ever recovers control. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery.
Okay, at this point, we're going to take step one. We're going to have a question. Please stand, and I'll ask the question. Simply answer yes or no. Do you concede to your innermost self that you're an alcoholic? Okay, thank you. Let's move on to step two.
Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity.
Okay, in step two, there's two components, power greater than ourself and restored to sanity. Restored to sanity means that we don't pick up the first drink. Well, let's go to page 8, paragraph 1. Page 8, paragraph 1. And it starts with, no words can tell.
No words can tell of the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. Trembling, I stepped from the hospital a broken man. Fear sobered me for a bit. Then came the insidious insanity of that first drink. And on Armistice Day, 1934, I was off again. Everyone became resigned to the certainty that I would have to be shut up somewhere or would stumble along to a miserable end. How dark it is before the dawn. In reality, that was the beginning of my last debauch. I was soon to be catapulted into what I like to call the fourth dimension of existence.
Okay, Bill Wilson, in his chapter one, Bill's story, on page 8, just described his higher power. He said alcohol was his master. And then he said he was sober for a bit, fear sobered him for a bit, but he picked up the first drink. And when you pick up the first drink and you're an alcoholic, you trigger the physical phenomenon of craving. This is a great example of your life being unmanageable. Let's go to page 154, paragraph 3. Page 154, paragraph 3. And it starts with, of course he couldn't drink.
Of course, he couldn't drink. But why not sit hopefully at a table, a bottle of ginger ale before him? After all, had he not been sober 6 months now? Perhaps he could handle, say, 3 drinks, no more. Fear gripped him. He was on thin ice. Again, it was the old insidious insanity, that first drink. With a shiver, he turned away, and walked down the lobby to the church directory.
Here's a great example of being restored to sanity. Our co-founder, Bill Wilson, was in Akron, Ohio at the time. And as it says in the big book, he was sober for 6 months, and his mind tells him it's okay to drink. But he was restored to sanity, and he walked away to the church directory to make some phone calls to try to help somebody else. And that's how AA started. I have an actual recording of Bill Wilson describing what you've just read in the big book. So let's listen.
So here I was on a Saturday afternoon, alone in the Mayflower Hotel at Akron, Ohio. I walked down to the lobby, strolled back and forth. At one end there was a plaque with the names of the various churches and preachers. At the other end of my beat there was a bar room. The bar room was filling up, and so were the people in it. and that buzz so characteristic to bars had a pleasant sound to me. Soon I found myself saying, well, perhaps I could go in there and have a drink of ginger ale and possibly scrape an acquaintance to pass away this lonely afternoon. And then I caught myself and thought, well, I have been restored to sanity. I can see I'm in danger. I walked over to the church directory again, thinking, well, now perhaps I had better find an alcoholic that I might talk to. Because at last, I see that I need such a person as much as he could possibly need me. No more of this preaching I had been doing in New York. So here I was, standing in front of the church directory, wondering what next. It suddenly occurred to me that perhaps one of the preachers on the list there could refer me to a drunk that I might work on. My fingers slid down across the list and finally stopped at the name of Walter Tunks, later to become a wonderful friend of AA and who happened to be the Episcopal rector in the town. So I called up the good reverend, explained my need for a drunk to work on. At first, he was rather nonplussed. He almost remarked that one drunk at a time is enough. Anyhow, he caught the drift of what I needed, and he referred me to still another person, a member of the Oxford groups in Akron. And from him, I secured a list of about 10 people that might any one of them put me in contact with a drunk. Well, I felt better, went upstairs, got on the phone, and one after one, the calls fell through. They didn't answer. They could perhaps see me in church on Sunday. One after another, the list was all gone, excepting the very last name. And this name was Henrietta Seiberling. And I connected her with Frank Seiberling, the rubber tycoon who I had met years before. Well, I couldn't imagine going to Mrs. Seiberling on a Saturday afternoon, asking if she knew of a drunk that I might work on. I even went downstairs and walked up and down some more. Suddenly, something said to me, you had better call that number. So I did call, and a warm southern voice came over the wire. This was Henrietta Seiberling. She was the daughter-in-law, not the one I thought. I explained my need, and she said, well, I'm no alcoholic, but I've had my troubles. I think I understand. Won't you come right straight out here? In no time, I stood before Henrietta's house, which was the gatehouse to that great estate. She met me in the door, showed me in, and listened while I poured out my story. Finally, she said, I think you should meet Dr. Baum. He's a surgeon here in town. He's been in our Oxford groups. He's tried all sorts of cures. I'm sure he wants to stop drinking, but he simply can't. The family is in awful shape. The kids are in disarray. Henrietta went on to say that Ann Smith, Bob's wife, was about on the verge of a nervous breakdown. Moreover, the mortgage on the house was close to being foreclosed. Things just simply couldn't be worse. So, said Henrietta, would you like to talk with him? Well, I certainly thought I would. I needed him as much as he needed me.
Okay, did you catch that? He was down to the last name, and that's how close AA almost didn't happen. Anyway, I just wanted to illustrate, you know, Bill was working with others. None of them were staying sober, but he was. So being unselfish and trying to help others saved the day. And when he tried to help Dr. Bob, he was restored to sanity. We're still in Bill's story. We're going to hear Bill describe the spirit of the universe. And then later on, his friend, who is sober through the Oxford group, comes to visit and helps Bill try to get sober. And we'll hear that quote where it says, "Why don't you choose your own conception of God?" Go to page 10, paragraph 3. Page 10, paragraph 3.
I had always believed in a power greater than myself. I had often pondered these things. I was not an atheist. Few people really are, for that means blind faith in the strange proposition that this universe originated in a cipher and aimlessly rushes nowhere. My intellectual heroes, the chemists, the astronomers, even the evolutionists, suggested vast laws and forces at work. Despite contrary indications, I had little doubt that a mighty purpose and rhythm underlay all. How could there be so much of precise and immutable law and no intelligence? I simply had to believe in a spirit of the universe who knew neither time nor limitation. But that was as far as I had gone.
Let's go to page 12, paragraph 1. Page 12, paragraph 1.
Despite the living example of my friend, there remained in me the vestiges of my old prejudice. The word God still aroused a certain antipathy. When the thought was expressed that there might be a God personal to me, this feeling was intensified. I didn't like the idea. I could go for such conceptions as creative intelligence, universal mind, or spirit of nature, but I resisted the thought of a czar of the heavens, however loving his sway might be. I have since talked with scores of men who felt the same way. My friend suggested what then seemed a novel idea. He said, "Why don't you choose your own conception of God?" That statement hit me hard. It melted the icy intellectual mountain in whose shadow I had lived and shivered many years. I stood in the sunlight at last. It was only a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself. Nothing more was required of me to make my beginning. I saw that growth could start from that point. Upon a foundation of complete willingness, I might build what I saw in my friend. Would I have it? Of course I would. Thus was I convinced that God is concerned with us humans when we want Him enough. At long last, I saw, I felt, I believed. Scales of pride and prejudice fell from my eyes. A new world came into view.
All right, let's go to page 47, paragraph 2. Page 47, paragraph 2.
We needed to ask ourselves but one short question. Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that there is a power greater than myself? As soon as a man can say that he does believe, or is willing to believe, we emphatically assure him that he is on his way. It has been repeatedly proven among us that upon this simple cornerstone, a wonderfully effective spiritual structure can be built. Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that there is a power greater than myself?
For those who want to take step two, please stand. This is the question for step two. Do you believe, or even willing to believe, that there is a power greater than yourself? Okay, thank you. This concludes our session for steps one and two. Thank you for being here, and thank you for letting me help you today. And hopefully I'll see you next week for steps three, four, and five. Here I have a couple quotes out of the big book. I want to share some information describing a sharing partner. A sharing partner is an alcoholic who's recovered from alcoholism through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, has had a spiritual awakening, and is willing to help the new person through the 12 steps.
Chapter 2. There is a solution. We of Alcoholics Anonymous know thousands of men and women who were once just as hopeless as Bill. Nearly all have recovered. They have solved the drink problem. We are average Americans. All sections of this country and many of its occupations are represented, as well as many political, economic, social, and religious backgrounds. We are people who normally would not mix. But there exists among us a fellowship, a friendliness, and an understanding which is indescribably wonderful. The ex-problem drinker who has found this solution, who is properly armed with facts about himself, can generally win the entire confidence of another alcoholic in a few hours. Until such an understanding is reached, little or nothing can be accomplished. That the man who is making the approach has had the same difficulty, that he obviously knows what he is talking about, that his whole deportment shouts at the new prospect that he is a man with a real answer, that he has no attitude of holier than thou, nothing whatever except the sincere desire to be helpful, that there are no fees to pay, no axes to grind, no people to please, no lectures to be endured. These are the conditions we have found most effective. Chapter 7. Working with others. Practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. It works when other activities fail. This is our 12th suggestion. Carry this message to other alcoholics. You can help when no one else can. You can secure their confidence when others fail. Remember, they are very ill. Life will take on new meaning. To watch people recover, to see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish, to see a fellowship grow up about you, to have a host of friends, this is an experience you must not miss. We know you will not want to miss it. Frequent contact with newcomers and with each other is the bright spot of our lives.
Beginner's Big Book Group provides sharing partners for those who want to take the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Will the sharing partners who want to work with others please raise your hand? Thank you. I have one last quote from the big book. It comes from the chapter, A Vision for You. And then we'll close with the Lord's Prayer.
Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you. Until then.
In honor of our AA pioneers in the old tradition, we'll simply stand without holding hands and close this meeting with the Lord's Prayer.